Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Deuteronomy chapter 4. I'm going to do the first 40 verses of chapter 4. This is Moses giving a speech, one of his three farewell speeches to the Israelites on the plains of Moab. And the main theme of this speech is don't do idolatry when you cross over into the promised land. Our context is this: the end of chapter 2 and all of chapter 3 dealt with the defeat of the Amorites who were possessing the land of the Moabites and the land of the Ammonites at the time that the Israelites were trying to pass through peacefully, but they wouldn't let them, and so Israel had to wipe them out, which they had done. And so Moses is kind of saying, all right, we've beaten the bad guys. Now, I want to charge you guys, you Israelites, to do good, to don't be idolaters when you cross the Jordan River. So we start now with Deuteronomy 4, verses 1 and 2. Now, O Israel, Moses starts, listen to the statutes and the judgments which I am teaching you to perform, so that you may live and go in and take possession of the land which the Lord, the God of your fathers, is giving you. You shall not add to the word which I am commanding you, nor take away from it, that you may keep the commandment of the Lord your God which I command you. Now Moses had gone to a great deal of trouble to receive the law at Mount Sinai. That had been 38 plus years earlier, and he didn't want to see that law, the effect of that law, the blessings of that law, disappear, which he knew could very well happen, because in that law there were curses, Deuteronomy 28. The curses preached from Mount Ebal, right north of Shechem, you recall that, and, or they eventually were going to be, when once they got into the promised land. So the law was full of curses, and Moses knew that, and he didn't want to see bad things happen to the Israelites. So he said, please, guys, follow the law that I gave you. I'm the lawgiver. Follow the law. Don't let it go to waste. And he had good reason to worry about these Israelites, because they had done nothing but rebel for the 40 years that they were on the wilderness. Rebellion was their middle name. Now, this idea of listen, of course, it means to listen and obey. I like the Chinese word for it, because their word for listen and obey, their word for obey is listen to the word. I believe it is listen to the word, listen. And they translate that as obey. This is a frequent theme in Deuteronomy, listening to God's word. Deuteronomy 5:1, then Moses summoned all Israel and said to them, hear, O Israel, the statutes and the ordinances which I am speaking today in your hearing, that you may learn them and observe them carefully, which I am speaking today in your hearing. Hear, O Israel, he's saying. He means hear and obey. Deuteronomy 6:3-4, O Israel, you should listen and be careful to do it, that it may be well with you and that you may multiply greatly, just as the Lord, the God of your fathers, has promised you in a land flowing with milk and honey. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. Hear, O Israel. Deuteronomy 9:1, hear, O Israel, you are crossing over the Jordan today to go in to possess nations greater and mightier than you. Hear, O Israel. Deuteronomy 23:20, verse 3. He shall say to them, hear, O Israel, you are approaching the battle against your enemies today. Do not be faint-hearted. So, besides Deuteronomy, the NIV Study Bible says this idea of hearing God is a frequent theme in other areas of the Old Testament besides Deuteronomy. And, of course, it's repeated so much is because we don't want to hear what God is trying to tell us. If we would, we'd be so much happier. So verse 1 says, listen, hear, listen to the statutes. Clark and Famous and Brown define statutes as ordinances respecting religion. The Israelites are also supposed to listen to judgments in verse 1. Clark and Jameson Foster and Brown distinguish judgments. They say all enactments relating to civil matters are judgments. Statutes are all ordinances respecting religion. I don't know about all these fine distinctions. Just obey what he says. I think it's granular enough. I remember somewhere in my notes, which I don't have in front of me, but Adam Clark, goes through all the legal distinctions between judgments and ordinances and commandments and laws and all. And I remember reading that and thinking, I don't really care. I think there are distinctions without a difference. I could be wrong. Now in verse 2, Moses tells the Israelites, you shall not add to the word which I am commanding you. And notice, he is commanding. He's not suggesting. He's commanding. He's the lawgiver. He's the leader. Don't add. This idea is very common because people love to add to the law. Look what the Pharisees did to it. Deuteronomy 12:32, whatever I command you, you shall be careful to do. You shall not add to, nor take away from it. Take it just like it's written. Every legalist needs to meditate upon these scriptures, about not adding to the scriptures. I was just talking to a Chinese Christian the other day, a young Christian asking me a lot of questions. She told me a fundamentalist pastor who was over there in China had told her that she was supposed to tithe on the net, not on the gross of her income. And I told her, well, is that in the Bible? No, he added to the Bible. I told her I would give him $3 million if he could prove that was in the Bible. People love to add to the Bible. Don't do it, please. Let me read you some scriptures about not adding to the Bible. Deuteronomy 12:32. Whatever I command you, you shall be careful to do. You shall not add nor take away from it. Proverbs 36. Do not add to his words, or he will reprove you, and you will be proved a liar. Do not add to his words. Galatians 3:15. Brethren, I speak in terms of human relations. Even though it is only a man's covenant, yet when it has been ratified, no one sets it aside or adds conditions to it. Revelation 22:18-19. I testify to everyone who hears the words of the prophecy. John is speaking the prophecy of this book. If anyone adds to them, God will add to him the plagues which are written in this book. Ooh, lots of plagues in the book of Revelation. If anyone takes away from the words of the book of this prophecy, God will take away his part from the tree of life and from the holy city which are written in this book. Folks, it's a serious thing to mess with God's word. All legalists, beware. We go now to Deuteronomy chapter 4, verses 3 and 4. Your eyes have seen what the Lord has done in the case of Baal Peor. Moses continues his speech to the Israelites. For all the men who followed Baal Peor, the Lord your God has destroyed them from among you. But you, who held fast to the Lord your God, are alive today, every one of you. Now Baal Peor, that's the incident that involved Balak, king of Moab, when he hired Balaam, the Syrian prophet, to come down and curse Israel. Balaam tried. He went to three mountains. Balak led him to, and each time he said, I don't think I'm going to curse him. He was scared of God. He wanted to because he wanted Balak's money. And finally, after that, the Moabite women, in league with the Midianite women that were around, they started seducing the Israelite men to have sex with them, probably for religious purposes, to join themselves to their pagan idols. God responded by destroying 24,000 people in a plague. Phinehas stayed the plague, the zealous Israelite Phinehas, by spearing Zimri and Cosby, Zimri being the Jewish guy and Cosby the Midianite woman, who were having sex in a tent. He speared them and stopped the plague. So that's what he's referring to there. God has destroyed them, all the men who followed Baal Peor. Verse 4, but you who held fast to the Lord your God are alive today. Now that held fast, that's a strong word. In fact, the King James translates that as cleave in the famous leave and cleave verse, Genesis 2:24. Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother, and shall cleave unto his wife. Modern translations would have it as hold fast unto his wife. Ruth held fast to Naomi. Ruth 1:14. This is King James. And they lifted up their voice and wept again, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clave unto her. That means, that's the past tense of cleave. I would have thought it would be cleaved, but no, it's clave. It just means held fast. Now, there are other scriptures that in Deuteronomy talking about holding fast to God. It means holding on to him tight, really tight. Deuteronomy 11:22, for if ye shall diligently keep all these commandments which I command you, to do them, to love the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, and to cleave unto him. I'm using the King James because that cleave is stronger. Deuteronomy 13:4, ye shall walk after the Lord your God and fear him and keep his commandments and obey his voice, and you shall serve him and cleave unto him. Deuteronomy 30:20, that thou mayest love the Lord thy God, and that thou mayest obey his voice, and that thou mayest cleave unto him, for he is thy life. So not only do we see Moses talking about listening to God, as in listen and obey. These scriptures are scattered all throughout Deuteronomy, listen scriptures, and now we have cleave scriptures. Hold fast, hold on to him, and not to those nasty idols. Moses finishes verse 4 by pointing out that everyone who survived the Baal Peor incident, nobody had died in the several months that had passed since then. John Gill says that's very remarkable, considering how many Israelites there were. There were over 2 million, if you recall. Deuteronomy 4, 5 through 6. Moses continues his speech to the Israelites. See, I have taught you statutes and judgments, just as the Lord my God commanded me, that you should do this in the land where you are entering to possess it. So keep and do them, For that is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the peoples who will hear all these statutes and say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. Keep and do them, Moses says in verse 6, for that is your wisdom. Here's what Clark comments on that, quote, there was no mode of worship at this time on the face of the earth that was not wicked, obscene, puerile, foolish, or ridiculous. And that's true. That's what idolatry leads to. Absolute stupidity. I think of the idolatrous Americans who are polluting the nation of America right now. They are wicked, they are obscene, they're puerile, they're foolish, and they're ridiculous. These woke jokes that are running around everywhere, trying to fight racism with racism, tearing down statues, terrorizing people, trying to kick people out of their jobs, canceling people. They are wicked, obscene, puerile, foolish, and ridiculous. Why? Because they've rejected God. The laws, however, are your wisdom. Adam Clark says, take away what Asia and Europe, whether ancient or modern, have barred from the Mosaic laws, and you leave little behind that can be called excellent. Well, Clark was writing in the 1800s when Asia and Europe was ruled by a bunch of despots. Here's what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say about the wisdom of the law. Quote, although the heathen world generally ridiculed the Hebrews for what they considered a foolish and absurd exclusiveness, some of the most eminent philosophers expressed the highest admiration of the fundamental principle in the Jewish religion, the unity of God, and their legislators barred some laws from the constitution of the Hebrews. John Gill says, quote, indeed the best laws that they, referring to the classical Greeks and Romans, indeed the best laws that they had seemed to be barred from the Jews. Now I know in a lot of these old commentators they think that the Jews had access to Moses. The Greeks had access to Moses. The Greeks were not that far away geographically. If you look at the map, they are fairly close, but I don't think there's any proof that they actually borrowed from the Hebrews, the Hebrew scriptures. And so I take these older statements from the older commentators with a little bit of grain of salt. However, I will say this, that the Old Testament law greatly influenced, for example, the American Constitution, which has provided more freedom for political freedom for any nation ever, and which constitution has been imitated over all the world in the modern era. And a lot of the legal principles came from the Old Testament. And that would be a great study, which is on my do list, actually. I haven't done it yet, but I am sure that there's a lot of inspiration from the Old Testament legal law that affected the legal system of both Europe and America, and from there, the rest of the Western world, and now even into the Asian world. But at any rate, Moses says, the law is your wisdom, it's your understanding. In the sight of all the peoples who will hear all these statutes, well, how are the pagan nations going to hear? Well, here's John Gill giving a couple of options. He said philosophers could have traveled into Israel. Maybe. I think his other suggestion is better. Eventually, all the pagan nations are going to hear about the Jewish laws from the Septuagint translation into Greek. We know that Koine Greek spread all over the Roman Empire and was spreading in a couple of centuries before Jesus arrived. And the Septuagint translation, what was that? I think it was 2nd century B.C., somewhere around there. And then everybody could read Greek, and now everybody had the Hebrew scriptures. So, and besides that, we're still talking about the law today. I'm talking about it right now. So the peoples who will hear all these statutes, that's a lot of people in the world, including you, because we're talking about it right now. And people will look at that and they will say, surely this nation of Israel is a great nation, a wise and understanding people. Well, it's interesting how times have changed. Now the nations mock the Old Testament for being backward and primitive and, oh my gosh, I killed all the women and children in the warfare. And yeah, well, smarty pants, enlightenment folks. They don't think the Jews are so wise, but I do. Wise and understanding people because of that law. Deuteronomy 4, 7 and 8. For what great nation is there that has a God so near to it as is the Lord our God whenever we call on him? Or what great nation is there that has statutes and judgments as righteous as this whole law which I am setting before you today? Moses said, what great nation is there? The great nation he's referring to, I guess, is Israel. Now, the Israelites were not as great as other nations with regard to many things. Here's some examples that John Gill says. They didn't have the great population that other nations had. The extent of their territory was not as extensive. They were not as wealthy. They didn't have as much military ability. But the reasons that they were great is because they were governed by God. God was near them when they prayed. For what great nation is there that has a God so near? How was God near to the Israelites? Well, the NIV Study Bible says Israelites always had access to God in prayer, of course, and God's presence was actually symbolized by the tabernacle that was located in the center of the camp, as we talked about in the first part of Numbers. The pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire that led them by day and night, that pillar was the Shekinah glory of God, and which meant that God was camped right there above the tabernacle, or inside the Holy of Holies above the Ark of the Covenant. So God was there where the Israelites could physically see him, or at least see a representation of him. You can't see God and live, of course, but could see the Shekinah glory. And that was a big deal. And Moses is appealing to that. Whenever we call on him, there he is. If you'll just call on him, Israel, or what great nation is there that has statutes and judgments as righteous as this whole law? There is no other nation who is called to worship this personal God, this caring God, this God with loving kindness. We go now to Deuteronomy 4, verses 9 through 10. Only give heed to yourself, Moses continues, speaking to the Israelites, and keep your soul diligently, so that you do not forget the things which your eyes have seen, and they do not depart from your heart all the days of your life, but make them known to your sons and your grandsons. So not only during your life, but also your descendants' lives. Keep the knowledge of the law alive. Verse 10, remember the day you stood before the Lord your God at Horeb, that's Mount Sinai, when the Lord said to me, assemble the people to me, that I may let them hear my words, so they may learn to fear me all the days they live on the earth, and that they may teach their children. Teach your children the law, your sons and your grandsons. That reminds me of the Crosby, Stills, and Nash song, teach your children, teach them well. It's something that's sort of ingrained in the human race. We need to pass our values down to our kids. Now, some of those values might be bad and might be wrong, but if your values are halfway decent, you don't want to just keep them to yourself. You want to pass them down. It's instinctive even. But Moses is saying, look, teach your children. This idea of teaching your children is in the law and other places. Deuteronomy 11:19, you shall teach them the statutes to your sons, talking of them when you sit in your house and when you walk along the road and when you lie down and when you rise up. In other words, all the time, teach them, not just in classrooms. Exodus 12, verses 26 and 27, and when your children say to you, what does this rite mean to you? It's talking about the Passover. You shall say, it is a Passover sacrifice to the Lord who passed over the houses of the sons of Israel in Egypt when he smote the Egyptians. And so when your children say to you, what does this rite mean? You tell them, it's Passover. Deuteronomy 6, 6 through 7. These words which I am commanding you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your sons, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. Teach your children. Now Moses in verse 10 says, remember the day you stood before the Lord your God at Horeb at Mount Sinai. Remember, this idea of remembering is a common theme in Deuteronomy. Let's look at this. Deuteronomy 5:15. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. Deuteronomy 7:18. You shall not be afraid of them. You shall well remember what the Lord your God did to Pharaoh who went to all Egypt. Deuteronomy 8:2. You shall remember all the way which the Lord your God has led you in the wilderness these 40 years. Deuteronomy 8:18. But you shall remember the Lord your God, for it is he who is giving you power to make wealth. Deuteronomy 9:7, remember, do not forget how you provoked the Lord your God to wrath in the wilderness. Deuteronomy 9:27, remember your servants Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Deuteronomy 15:15, you shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. Deuteronomy 16:3, you shall not eat leavened bread within it, so that you may remember all the days of your life, the day when you came out of the land of Egypt. Deuteronomy 16:12, you shall remember that you were a slave in Egypt. Deuteronomy 24:9, remember what the Lord your God did to Miriam on the way as she came out of Egypt. Deuteronomy 24:18, but you shall remember that you were a slave in Egypt, and that your Lord God, your God, redeemed you from there. Deuteronomy 24:22, you shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. Deuteronomy 25:17, remember what Amalek did to you along the way. That was a big fight at Rephidim that Joshua beat Amalek after they attacked. Deuteronomy 32:7, remember the days of old. Consider the years of all generations. So here is the third of the three key themes that we see in this speech. Moses tells the people to listen, and then he tells them to cleave to, or to hold fast to God. To listen to God, hold fast to God, and then remember all the bad stuff and all the good stuff that's happened to you. Let the events of your life be a lesson to you that you may teach your children, because people remember events and historical things much easier than they remember abstract formulations of doctrine. They really do. Now, in verse 10, Moses addresses, quote unquote, you. Remember the day you stood before the Lord. Well, actually, most of the people he's addressing right now were little kids under 20, or maybe not even having been born, because that was 38 plus years ago. Most of the people who were over 20 at the giving of the law at Mount Sinai had died while wandering around in the wilderness. They all kicked the bucket before Moses crossed the brook Zered into Moab, as we read a couple of chapters ago. And so the people that Moses is addressing at Sinai is a new generation. But the you there shows that the ancestors and the descendants are tied together in one entity, you, Israel. We go now to Deuteronomy 4, verses 11 through 14. You came near and stood at the foot of the mountain. Again, most of them didn't personally do that, but what he means is you, Israel, came near and stood at the foot of the mountain, and the mountain burned with fire to the very heart of the heavens. It's a volcano, probably. Darkness, cloud, and thick gloom. That's a lot of smoke coming out of the volcano. Maybe there was also storm clouds in the atmosphere as well. Then the Lord spoke to you from the midst of the fire. You heard the sound of words, but you saw no form, only a voice. So he declared to you his covenant, which he commanded you to perform. That is the Ten Commandments. And he wrote them on two tablets of stone. The Lord commanded me at that time to teach you statutes and judgments, that you might perform them in the land where you are going over to possess it. Now we want to point out here the key verse, verse 12, where Moses tells the people that they only heard words. They saw no form. What's the big deal about hearing words and seeing no form? Well, because the thrust of Moses' next exhortation is, don't do idolatry, because when you got the law, did you see a form up there? Did you see a fish or a bird or an ox or a cow or a goat? No, you didn't see anything. You only heard a voice. So that means forget idols. You always got to put God in the shape of a golden calf or some nonsense like that. No. You only heard a voice. You did not see an image, a form. This idea that I just told you is confirmed in Deuteronomy 4:15, which is our next verse. For your own good, be extremely careful, because you did not see any form on the day the Lord spoke to you out of the fire at Horeb. So again, that's why Moses brought that up there. The Ten Commandments are said to be put on a stone here by Moses. That emphasizes their durability. They're going to last. Remember, you teach yourselves all your lives, and then your children, and then your grandchildren. The law is supposed to last. It's not a one-off commandment given by God that should be forgotten in the next generation. We go down to Deuteronomy 4, verses 15 through 19. So watch yourselves carefully, since you did not see any form on the day the Lord spoke to you at Horeb from the midst of the fire, so that you do not act corruptly and make a graven image for yourselves in the form of any figure. Graven means carved. The likeness of male or female. The likeness of any animal that is on the earth, the likeness of any winged bird that flies in the sky, the likeness of anything that creeps on the ground, the likeness of any fish that is in the water below the earth. Now, Moses mentions all these things because this is what people did. They made idols out of anything. They see it, some kind of animal. Hey, let's make an idol out of this and worship it. Oh, there's a worm. Oh, there's a fire ant. Let's make an idol out of a fire ant. Oh, a slug. Let's make an idol out of a slug. Oh, a blackwater spider. Let's make an idol out of a blackwater spider. I'm exaggerating, of course, but this is how stupid this is. Moses continues, verse 19, Deuteronomy 4, and beware not to lift up your eyes to heaven and see the sun and the moon and the stars. Oh, now we're finished with animals, so let's look up in the heavens and make some gods out of what we see up in the sky. Don't lift up your eyes to the moon, the stars, and all the host of heaven, the stars, and be drawn away and worship them and serve them, those which the Lord your God has allotted to all the peoples under the whole heaven. In other words, God gave those stars to everybody because everybody can see them. But don't make an idol out of them. He does mention, don't make any idol in the form of any figure, the likeness of male or female. There were a lot of female goddesses, as you know, I'm sure, idols. Ashtarte was the prime example of this, and she's my favorite. I say favorite. She's my most unfavorite female idol because she was worshipped with painted eggs, from which we get Astarte eggs. And it's amazing to me how many Christians, being ignorant of history, ignorant of idolatry, ignorant of just about everything, except maybe John 3:16, they will take their kids out on Resurrection Sunday when we're supposed to be celebrating the resurrection of Jesus, and they'll take their kids out and they'll look for Easter eggs. Deuteronomy 4, verses 20 and 21. But the Lord has taken you and brought you out of the iron furnace from Egypt to be a people for his own possession as today. Now the Lord was angry with me on your account and swore that I would not cross the Jordan and that I would not enter the good land which the Lord your God has given you as an inheritance. Now here Egypt is referred to an iron furnace that held the Israelites. The NIV has it an iron smelting furnace. In other words, it's not a furnace made out of iron. It's a furnace that creates iron, that produces iron. And iron, of course, when it's in its furnace, is afflicted, tested, and refined. You don't really say afflicted. Iron is not afflicted. But if you were iron in the service, you in the furnace, you would say you were being afflicted. So it's a good metaphor. Now, Egypt is called an iron furnace in other places in the Old Testament scripture. 1 Kings 8:51. For they are your people and your inheritance, which you have brought forth from Egypt from the midst of the iron furnace. Jeremiah 11:4. I commanded your forefathers in the day that I brought them out of the land of Egypt from the iron furnace. Isaiah 48:10. Behold, I have refined you, but not as silver. I have tested you in the furnace of affliction. Doesn't mention iron there, but the idea is there is God is afflicting people in a furnace, and the Israelites were being afflicted. Now, we all know that suffering produces a refinement, and Christians suffer, and they come out on the other end of the suffering with more fruit, more love, more gratitude for God. But notice this. The Egyptians were slaves. They were being tested and refined in their iron furnace in Egypt, and yet God brought them out. And the testing was over. Well, I don't say it was over. They were tested in the wilderness, of course. But ultimately, they got to the promised land. And so if we're going through testing today, I'm going to make an application here. Remember, God wants to get you out of that testing. So don't sit here and say, this is going to be my lot for the rest of my life. And then you are defeated. You're not merely suffering. You are defeated. You've got to trust God to get you out of the suffering and to build your character along the way, of course. But ultimately, he's going to get you out of the suffering. He's going to deliver you. What did Paul say in Acts 14? I have suffered many tribulations. We suffer many tribulations as we go into the kingdom of God, but God delivered me from them all. He delivered me. People love to talk about tribulation and suffering and how it builds our character. I hear that, and that's fine, but where's the other side of that? Victory through the suffering, deliverance from the suffering. That should be a theme for present-day evangelical teachers also. Verse 20. Israel is referred to as a people of God's own possession. In other words, God owned Israel. The NIV has an inheritance of God. God is going to inherit Israel. A little bit different take on it. God's people make him happy. Usually if you get a bequest or a legacy and a will, the beneficiary of said will is very happy. And so if the Israelites were God's inheritance, God should have been happy with them despite their failings. And likewise, we are God's inheritance. We're people for his own possession, as Peter said. So we should make God happy. I'm sure we do. Otherwise, he wouldn't mess with us. Deuteronomy 32:9 has this idea of Israel being God's inheritance. For the Lord's portion is his people. Jacob is the allotment of his inheritance. Jacob, of course, is Israel. Another way of saying the people of Israel is the allotment of his inheritance. God's inheritance, Yahweh's inheritance, is Israel. Now, Moses in verse 21 says that the Lord was angry with me on your account. He's referring to the unfortunate incident at Kadesh Barnea when there was no water and Moses was told to speak to the rock to get water for the Israelites, and he struck the rock. God got angry. People debate on why. I'll give you three possibilities: because Moses was angry and he didn't represent God well. Two, God told him to speak to the rock, and Moses struck to the rock, so he was disobedient. Third possibility is that he was arrogant because he told the Israelites, we could give you water, when he should have said, God could give you water. And I've got about nine other possibilities when we went over that passage, so it's controversial exactly what Moses meant. But we do know God was angry with Moses, and he was so angry that he swore, made an oath, you ain't going into the land of Israel, Moses. Whoa, that seems so serious. So I infer from that that what Moses did was serious too, even though I can't really read the text and get an emotional feel for how bad Moses behaved there. I mean, just looking at it, I would say, nah, Moses, you may need to repent, but you can still go into the promised land. But that's not the way God looked at it. I guess with rank goes responsibility. And this swearing that God did that Moses would not cross the Jordan is an extra detail that we don't get from the original account. This is mentioned here in Deuteronomy. We go now to Deuteronomy 4, verses 22 through 24. Moses continues, speaking to the Israelites, I won't be crossing the Jordan because I am going to die in this land. But you are about to cross over and take possession of this good land. Be careful not to forget the covenant of the Lord your God that he made with you, and make an idol for yourselves in the shape of anything he has forbidden you. Oh, I should read that again. Be careful not to make an idol for yourselves in the shape of anything he has forbidden you. For the Lord your God is a consuming fire, a jealous God. Now, this is not the first time Moses in verse 22 says, I won't be crossing the Jordan. He's already mentioned it before, as I've said, but he repeats it. And Gill says the repetition of this probably shows that the prohibition of Moses entering the land had a big, or obviously shows that this prohibition had a big, big effect on Moses. It bothered him. He didn't like it. He asked God, hey, please, please, you don't let me go. Nope. God swore, you're not going into the land. Now, God is described as a consuming fire in verse 24. That's not the only place that Moses does this. Deuteronomy 9:3, know therefore today that it is the Lord your God who is crossing over before you as a consuming fire. That's sort of repetitious. A fire, by definition, consumes its fuel, but it does bring forth what the fire does and makes it more explicit when you state it that way. And of course, consuming fire means the fire destroys everything in its path. Continuing in Deuteronomy 9:3, he, God, will destroy them, the Canaanites, and he will subdue them before you so that you may drive them out and destroy them quickly. So the consuming fire means he's going to consume the Canaanites. Now, in Deuteronomy 4, Moses mentions that God is a consuming fire, not to talk about consuming the Canaanites. He's talking about consuming the Israelites if they get into idolatry, because God is jealous. He don't like that, you worshiping another god. Exodus 24:17, and to the eyes of the sons of Israel, the appearance of the glory of the Lord was like a consuming fire on the mountaintop. So even the symbol of God, the fire at Mount Sinai, was consuming fire. I don't know what it was consuming up there. Probably the top of the mountain, all the sulfur up there. Now, God is also called, besides a consuming fire, a jealous God in verse 24. This idea of God being jealous is also found in Deuteronomy 5:9. You shall not worship them or serve them, for I, the idols, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. Deuteronomy 6:15, for the Lord your God in the midst of you is a jealous God. The anger of the Lord will be kindled against you, and he will wipe you off the face of the earth. Ooh. That's kind of like if my wife decided she wanted another boyfriend and I went around to see him with a loaded, packing some heat. I could wipe him off the face of the earth because, you know, even humans don't like it when they are betrayed in their covenant relationships. And God doesn't like it either. And God's got a reason not to like it. He's got a right to be jealous, just as a husband has the right to be jealous or a wife has the right to be jealous. Here's another one, Exodus 20, verse 5. You shall not worship them or serve them, the idols, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children, on the third and the fourth generations of those who hate me. And again, that's talking about children who are continuing with the idolatry. It's not like they were innocent children. And then, of course, Adam Clark points out that God was actually a consuming fire in the case of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, Korah's rebellion. Remember, some of that judgment was an earthquake, but the rest of the judgment was a big fire. Probably started by lightning is what I would think, that burn up the rebels of Korah's rebellion. We go now to Deuteronomy 4, verses 25 through 28. When you become the father of children and children's children, and have remained long in the land, and act corruptly, and make an idol in the form of anything, and do that which is evil in the sight of the Lord your God, so as to provoke him to anger, I call heaven and earth to witness against you today, that you will surely perish quickly from the land where you are going over the Jordan to possess it. You shall not live long on it, but will be utterly destroyed. The Lord will scatter you among the peoples, and you will be left few in number among the nations where the Lord drives you. There you will serve gods, the work of man's hands, wood and stone, which neither see, nor hear, nor eat, nor smell. So basically, Moses is saying, you want to do idolatry? You're going to be destroyed. application time, what about the United States of America? Do we have idols in the land today? Oh boy, do we ever. Self-gratification, entertainment, money, sex, fame. Oh, I'm an influencer on YouTube. I'm happy now. And what happens to idolaters? They are scattered. At least they were in the case of Moses. I don't know why God's changed any since then. We shall see. Now, Moses calls heaven and earth to witness, verse 26. This is basically an oath that Moses was swearing, as Adam Clark points out. This idea of calling heaven and earth, we see it in Deuteronomy 13:19. I call heaven and earth to witness against you today that I have set before you life and death, the blessing and the curse. So choose life in order that you may live, you and your descendants. So when Moses calls heaven and earth to witness, that covers everything. If you're in heaven, you're going to see everything on the earth. And if you're on the earth looking up, you're going to see everything also. So he's saying, I want everybody to know that you're going to die if you commit idolatry. Isaiah 1:2, listen, O heavens, and hear, O earth. For the Lord speaks, listen, O heavens, hear, O earth. I call heaven and earth to witness. That means everybody, a complete and full witness. So there's nobody in Israel that's destroyed by idolatry that can say, well, nobody ever told me. Deuteronomy 32:1, give ear, O heavens, and let me speak, and let the earth hear the words of my mouth. Let everybody hear this solemn imprecation upon idolatrous Israelites. Now, Moses promises that God will scatter the Israelites among the peoples. That actually happened twice. The first time, Assyria came in and wiped out the northern 10 tribes in 722, going on into 721. That's the scattering of the 10 lost tribes, as they're called, the 10 lost tribes of Israel. The reason they're lost is because they never came back. We don't know what happened to them. Assyria deported the Israelites and scattered them through all the other regions of its empire. And then, of course, the famous Babylonian exile in 586. There was a return from that for the southern two tribes, Judah and Benjamin. They came back, but they were scattered for 70 years. This idea of Israel being scattered because of idolatry, Deuteronomy is repeated again in Deuteronomy 28:64. Moreover, the Lord will scatter you among all peoples from one end of the earth to the other end of the earth. And there you shall serve other gods, wood and stone, which you and your fathers have not known. That's sort of a repeat from our verse here. For example, in Deuteronomy 4:28, we see the same thing. There you will serve gods, the work of man's hands. You will serve gods, wood and stone. Now, there's a slight problem here because, in the case at least of the Babylonian exile, the Israelites didn't serve idols in Babylon. They learned their lesson, and they said, no, that's it for idolatry. In fact, idolatry disappeared from Israel after the Babylonian exile. After the Babylonian exile, Israelites didn't perform idolatry when they returned. So what this verse means, according to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, is you will go to Babylon and you will serve gods because the people there are serving gods, and you're going to serve the people who are serving those idols. And so you're going to be doing service for the gods of the land of your exile. I think that makes a lot of sense, actually. Of course, that's just for the two tribes of the Babylonian exile. I'm sure the Assyrians, when they were scattered, they probably went and worshiped idols in the places they were scattered to. We go now to Deuteronomy 4:29-31. But from there you will seek the Lord your God, and you will find him if you search for him with all your heart and all your soul. From there, that means in the place that you were scattered to in your exile. That, of course, did happen with the Babylonians. They came back and rebuilt the temple through Ezra, Zerubbabel, Nehemiah. You know the story. From there you will seek the Lord your God, and you will find him if you search for him with all your heart and all your soul when you are in distress and all these things have come upon you. In the latter days you will return to the Lord your God and listen to his voice. For the Lord your God is a compassionate God. He will not fail you, nor destroy you, nor forget the covenant with your fathers which he swore to them. Now this provocative phrase, latter days, is found in verse 30. In the latter days you will return. I can hear the prophecy people know. Oh, that's the last days and the end of the world. People will return to God right before Jesus comes back in the seven-year tribulation and da-da-da-da-da-da. And you know how the story goes. Folks, the latter days does not mean the end of the world. It's talking about here, it's talking about at the end of the Old Testament order, the legal Mosaic order, and the establishment of the Messianic age. So the latter days would be the Messianic age. In that day you return to the Lord your God and listen to his voice. Why? Because people return to Jesus. Jameson Fawcett Brown says that the age of Messiah is commonly called the latter days. As a matter of fact, I had a friend who was trying to deal with Micah 4 because a dispensationalist said, look here, it says that God will restore Israel in the latter days. So I said, okay. He says, how do I handle this? So I started looking up some commentators that looked at the word latter days, and oh, Chain, Calvin, Ellicott, oh, there was tons of them. I found about 10. Latter days refers to the age of the Messiah. Jameson Fawcett Brown, of course, is one such commentator. We need to get Hal Lindsey out of our system and Tim LaHaye out of our system. Latter days means the days of Jesus, the Messiah. Verse 31 says, for the Lord your God is a compassionate God. He will not fail you nor destroy you or forget the covenant. So God here is said to be compassionate, and this is in the Old Testament. Now, you know how many people say, oh, the Old Testament God is a God of wrath. There's no love of God in the Old Testament. And then they'll say, and in the New Testament, there's nothing but love and peace from Jesus. There's no wrath, despite the fact that Jesus turned over the table, despite the fact that Jesus prophesied that not one stone was going to be left on that temple in AD 70 when the Romans came to judge Israel. Judgment, wrath. There's no wrath in the New Testament. Well, in the Old Testament, we see here that God is compassionate. Now, I note this. That doesn't preclude, that statement that God is compassionate doesn't preclude God from punishing those who don't return. I mean, you want to see some curses who don't return to God and listen to him. Think of the curses in Deuteronomy 28. Oh, man, hemorrhoids, sickness, military defeat, famine, all kinds of horrible stuff if you disobey God. But that doesn't mean he's not compassionate. He's compassionate when you obey him, when you return to him and listen to his voice. You'll experience the compassion of God. Verse 31, Moses says, God will not fail you, nor destroy you, nor forget the covenant with your fathers. That covenant, of course, is the famous land and offspring and blessings covenant that was originally sworn to Abraham and confirmed to Isaac. I won't go through the scriptures. I've done that many, many times. Starts with Genesis 12, Genesis 15. Now, this idea of God swearing. Now, you know, there's a lot of Christians of the Amish Mennonite persuasion that will tell you that swearing an oath is sinful. And, of course, you give them a verse right here, well, God swore. If God can do it, why can't I imitate God like Paul did, 1 Corinthians 11:1. Imitate God. Imitate me even as I imitate God. Well, besides, you can find Paul, if I remember correctly, saying, as I live, making some kind of an oath, as God is my witness. So there's lots of oaths. What Jesus was preaching against in the Sermon on the Mount was false oaths, rash oaths, oaths that weren't kept, oaths that were making a mockery out of truth and justice. He was not talking about oaths in general. And in fact, we see Abraham taking an oath in Genesis 21:23. Now, therefore, swear to me, Abraham's talking, hear by God that you, this is King Abimelech of Gerar, which is right south of Gaza, little tiny kingdom down there, swear that you will not deal falsely with me. Abraham swore, Genesis 22:16, and said, by myself, this is God speaking to Abraham, to Isaac. By myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this thing, have not withheld your son, Isaac, your only son, up on the Mount Moriah. So God swore. Abraham swore. Hebrews 6:13 says, for when God made the promise to Abraham, since he could swear by no one greater, he swore by himself. Nothing wrong with God swearing. And you could say, well, that's God, but you can't do what God does. Well, but Abraham swore in Genesis 21. He's not rebuked for it. That just happens to be one of my pet peeves. Now, when you swore a covenant, the United Study Bible points out that the swearing of a covenant, you swore that you would destroy yourself if you violated the covenant. They would kind of do a mark over their innards and say, I'm going to slice myself up from left to right. A self-maledictory oath, in other words. I'm going to swear to harm myself if I don't keep this covenant. So swearing was a big deal. And that's why when you mock swearing by not doing it properly, that it's a bad thing, a very bad thing. But at any rate, that's a little rabbit trail. Moses said that God will not forget the covenant, which he swore. When God swears, it's going to happen, folks. It's unconditional. Deuteronomy 4:32-34, indeed, and now concerning the former days which were before you, since the day that God created man on the earth, and inquire from one end of the heavens to the other, has anything been done like this great thing, or has anything been heard like it? Has any people heard the voice of God speaking from the midst of the fire, as you have heard it, and survived? Or has a God tried to go to take for himself a nation from within another nation, by trials, by signs and wonders, talking about Egypt, and by war, and by a mighty hand, and by an outstretched arm, and by great terrors, as the Lord your God did for you in Egypt before your eyes? Now Moses asked Israel concerning the former days in verse 32. That means ages past, because he says from the day that God created man on the earth. And notice he did not say from the day that God evolved man on the earth. Are you listening, Christian evolutionist? Has anything been done like this great thing? Talking about the Exodus. Has anything been done like this Exodus? Here's what Clark says about that. Quote, a most extraordinary thing that a whole people consisting of upwards of 600,000 effective men, besides women and children, should, without striking a blow, be brought out of the midst of a very powerful nation, that's Egypt, to the political welfare of which their services were so essential, that's because they were slaves, helping the Egyptians out, that they should be brought out in so open and public a manner that the sea itself should be supernaturally divided to afford this mighty host a passage, and that in a desert utterly unfriendly to human life, they should be sustained for 40 years. The Exodus is a big deal. That's why Cecil B. DeMille made a movie about it and why Charlton Heston starred in it. A big, big deal. Now, down in Egypt, they were, in verse 34, trials were mentioned. That's a general term referring to all that the Israelites had gone through in the Exodus. There were many trials, all right. The Red Sea starting with that. They fought the Amalekites. They had Korah's rebellion. They got defeated at Hormah when they didn't listen to the two good spies and then tried to take the land after God said no retreat back to the Red Sea. All kinds of bad stuff. Trials everywhere. The signs that Moses talks about here, signs and wonders, that's probably the signs done by Moses, turning the rod into the snake, etc., the Gill says. The wonders, yeah, the signs and wonders, the 10 plagues of Egypt, ooh, those were some remarkable signs. The terrors that they went through in verse 34, it says that God delivered them by an outstretched arm and by great terrors. That probably refers to the drowning of the Red Sea and drowning Pharaoh, or maybe the 10 plagues that were inflicted on Egypt. Whatever, all that stuff is very clear that the Exodus from Egypt is something that mankind is never going to forget. And here we are, some 3.5 millennia later, we're still talking about it. That was a big deal. We go now to Deuteronomy chapter 4, verses 35 through 38. To you, Moses continues, to you Israelites, it was shown that you might know that the Lord, He is God. There is no other besides Him. What was shown? Well, the Exodus. Out of the heavens He let you hear His voice to discipline you, and on earth He let you see His great fire, and you heard His words from the midst of the fire. More particularly than the Exodus, it would be the giving of the law at Mount Sinai. Because He loved your fathers, therefore He chose their descendants after them, and He personally brought you from Egypt by His great power, driving out from before you nations greater and mightier than you, to bring you in and to give you their land for an inheritance as it is today. Now this phrase where Moses says there is no other God besides Him in verse 35, this is a blow at idolatry, of course, because every idol, if it were alive, would confess that there are other idols besides Him, because there are a million different idols out there. But God, there's only one God. There's no other God besides Him. As John Gill points out, this phrase, no other God besides God, is a phrase often used by Isaiah. And we hear that, we tend to get used to it, don't think about it too much, but no other God means there's no idolatry. Idols are worthless. Now in verse 36, Moses said that God let the Israelites see His great fire. We see that in Deuteronomy 4:12, a few verses previous that I've already mentioned. Then the Lord spoke to you at Mount Sinai from the fire. You kept hearing the sounds of the words, but you didn't see a form. There's only a verse from the fire. It's talking about the fire probably coming out of the volcano at Mount Sinai. Verse 37, God loved your fathers. Again, you don't think there's any love in the Old Testament? This is not Islam, folks. There's love. God is a God of love as well as a God of wrath and justice. Here's some scripture showing that God loved the Israelites, Deuteronomy 5:10, but showing loving kindness to thousands who love me and keep my commandments. Of course, there's the condition there. You got to obey. Deuteronomy 7:8-9, because the Lord loved you and kept the oath which He swore to your forefathers. Know therefore that the Lord your God, He is God, the faithful God who keeps His covenant and His loving kindness to a thousandth generation. Again, there's a condition with those who love him and keep his commandments. Deuteronomy 7:13, he will love you and bless you and multiply you. He will also bless the fruit of your womb and the fruit of your ground, your grain and your new wine and your oil, the increase of your herd and the young of your flock in the land which he swore to your forefathers to give you. That's love, folks. Again, I refer to these people who say that there's no love in the Old Testament. Have you ever read the Old Testament when you say something like that? Deuteronomy 10:15, yet on your fathers did the Lord set his affection to love them, and he chose their descendants after them, even you above all peoples. Deuteronomy 23:5, nevertheless, the Lord your God was not willing to listen to Balaam, but the Lord your God turned the curse into a blessing for you because the Lord your God loves you. Seriously, those who think the Old Testament doesn't have love, you should memorize and meditate upon these verses. The fathers that Moses is talking about in verse 37, he says, because God loved their fathers. Who were their fathers? That's their patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. As John Gill points out, I might want to add Joseph. But at any rate, verse 38, minor point here, Moses says that God was driving out from before you, nations greater and mightier. That's talking about the seven nations of Canaan. As John Gill points out, particularly the Amorites, they were the big dogs of the seven tribes of the Canaanites. We go now to Deuteronomy verses 39 and 40, and we'll finish this audio. Know therefore today, and take it to your heart, that the Lord, he is God in heaven above and on the earth below. There is no other. So you shall keep his statutes and his commandments, which I am giving you today, that it may go well with you and with your children after you, and that you may live long on the land which the Lord your God has given you for all time. Well, this is a nice summary. Obey, and good things are going to happen. That's basically what he says. And then, more particularly, he says, you may live long on the land. Again, he's talking about the land of Canaan that they're about to go in and fight for. You're going to live long there if you obey. Of course, the Israelites didn't obey, but if they had, they would have kept the land, but they didn't obey. Got the land taken from them by Assyria and by Babylonia. Now, notice that in verse 40, God is said to have given the land, though God is in the process of giving the land to Israel for all time. Well, now that's interesting. We can't take that literally because we know that there were periods during which the Israelites did not keep the land. For example, the Assyrian captivity, which started in 722. The ten lost tribes disappeared, so they lost their land. And then, of course, the Babylonian captivity wiped out the southern two tribes of Judah and Benjamin. And then in AD 70, the Romans wiped out Israel, and Israelites didn't get it back until 1948. That's a long period of time for Israel not having the land. So what does this mean? God's giving them the land for all time. Well, what you could do is say, yeah, he would give you the land for all time, meaning all the time of the old covenant until the new covenant came and until the shadow was over and the antitype arrived, the new covenant church. You could do that. Or you could say that the land was given to Israel conditionally, assuming they believed. I've mentioned that condition all the way through as I've been reading these scriptures. And, of course, the Israelites didn't obey. Not at all did they obey. So that promise for all-time possession of the land was conditional on obedience, which the Israelites did not fulfill. So, ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 40. In our next audio, we will finish up chapter 4. We will look at 9 verses. Verses 41 through 49 of chapter 4, the cities of refuge. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoy this one.